Kia ora and welcome to Deloitte New Zealand's State of the State 2019 podcast series. I'm Dave Lovett, Deloitte's public sector lead based here in Wellington. These episodes follow the article topics of this year's State of the State series. We'll explore how we can reduce inequities from different perspectives, how these inequities affect us, and what we can do to reduce them to build a fair future for all Kiwis. This series has been written in partnership with Victoria University of Wellington's School of Government. In this episode, I'm joined by co-authors of Article 3, Professor Michael McCauley from Victoria University's School of Government, and Anne Molyneux, an Associate Director in the Social Impact Practice here at Deloitte. Our guest today is Max Rashbrook, author, academic, and journalist, who has written extensively about inequities. Thank you all for joining us here today.
Thanks for having us.
So we're going to be talking about the third article in the series, Harnessing Voices to Expand Choices, where Michael and Anne explore how inequity reduces civic engagement and what we can do about it. If you haven't already, you can read it at deloitte.com/nz/state of the state. So Michael, if I can start with you, why is civic engagement an important contributor to well-being?
Thanks very much. So one of the crucial elements of our emotional well-being is a sense of ownership and agency in our lives. And that applies at the individual level, but it also applies at the public and the civic level. If people don't feel that there's a sense of agency, they have a feel of disaffection and a feel of powerlessness, and that creates and fosters a sense of illegitimacy with public decisions and policy decisions that are made on their behalf. So engagement obviously takes on many forms, from very direct participation through to deliberation, through to voting, through to just information sharing. But all of those elements create a sense of purpose, they create a sense of recognition of the citizenship involved and the decision-making capabilities that are involved, and it creates a sense of attachment to the decisions. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that people have to agree with the decisions, but obviously if there is a sense of engagement and deliberation, then there is a feeling that there is an attachment to the process, if not the actual outcome, all of which fosters a sense of civic harmony and good, healthy civil society.
And civic engagement isn't something that we tend to talk about a lot in New Zealand, at least not explicitly. I know there has been some discussion more recently with a local government conference that was held recently around, you know, the roles that local government play versus central government and things like that. But civic engagement isn't really something that is discussed that often. Is it something that is becoming increasingly important as a topic?
I think the recognition of it is becoming increasingly important, the acknowledgement of it. I think one of the ironies about the fact that it flies under the radar is that civic engagement in New Zealand is really quite strong, but it often isn't recognised, and it's often recognised as something else, community activity, local leadership. But all these things are forms of civic engagement. The official statistics from NZ Stats tells us that nearly one third of New Zealand's adult population are all in some formal voluntary position, whether that's at local or community level. And obviously, if you can expand and extrapolate on that to suggest that there's going to be a huge number more that are going to be involved in those kind of activities. So it's very important that these things get recognised and acknowledged. Whether or not that is the case, they still happen. But obviously, people need to feel valued. Again, this is all about well-being, civic and personal, and recognition leads to that.
And there's a danger of complacency as well, isn't there, I think? I mean, you're right that, you know, civic participation here is strong in many ways, but when you look at things like declining voter turnout and the way that we don't make much use of a lot of the things that we could be doing, you know, the more innovative forms of civic engagement, I sometimes think that that's because we're a bit complacent, if you know what I mean. You know, we think in New Zealand we've got it cracked already and we've got the best democracy in the world or whatever. And that feels to me like a slightly dangerous attitude.
I think partially that, Max. Partially perhaps it's a sense of collective modesty, that we don't like to shout our achievements from the rooftops. And so we're quite happy to let things go under the radar because we know that that's people are getting on with things and that's really the important thing. But I do wonder on a broader level whether or not that's the element that needs to be somewhat addressed. So again, it's not that we have to create new things. It's that we kind of give credit for the things that are already there and be a little bit more public-minded and a bit more public-spirited about that.
Mm. It's a good point. I think like a lot of
other areas of well-being, the high average participation and civic engagement masks potentially quite a number of inequities. And why are inequities in civic engagement a problem that we need to worry about?
Well, I think what we see at the moment is that the demographics in New Zealand are changing rapidly. We're becoming older, we're becoming less Pākehā, we're becoming much more diverse in terms of the types of communities that we have in New Zealand. And then coupled with that as well, we've had two successive governments now who have started to shine a real focus on this idea of well-being. So under the National government, it was focused on social investment. Under the Labour government, it's a focus on well-being. But they're both basically saying the same thing, that we want to care about the holistic well-being of individuals in their lives and not just about the economic prosperity of our country. And what that means when we start thinking about civic participation is that if we're going to achieve those well-being goals in an environment where the demographics are changing and we're becoming more diverse as a society, we're going to have to look at different ways of ensuring that the voices of all people are heard through democratic processes. Because at the moment, the risk that we get with a democratic society, and someone famous once said, you know, it's the worst system of government except for all of the others, is that you create the risk of creating a tyranny of the majority. And historically, that majority has been middle-class, white, Pākehā, people in New Zealand, which can come at the expense of the voices of more smaller or marginalised communities being heard through that process. But if we are to truly adopt this aspiration of saying, well, how do we address the well-being and bring everyone along with us in terms of that well-being journey, we're going to have to look very differently at how we ensure those minority voices are not just heard but also taken account of through civic participation processes, whether that's voting or through other mechanisms of being heard in a participatory democracy. And I think the added challenge to that is that those same groups whose voices are often, who come from those minority communities, are the same groups that historically have not been up there in terms of voter participation, for example. I'm thinking here of young people whose voter turnout rates are absolutely shocking. So if we're to truly address some of these inequities in our society, we need to be looking much more holistically about how we harness these voices to expand choices.
Thanks, Anne. And Max, the article talks about the ladder of participation, and Anne's just talked about, you know, different ways that civic participation can take place. But is participation enough?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think participation is hugely important, but I do think it needs to be accompanied by other things. And one of the things that I'm really strong on is deliberation, which you sort of loosely define as high-quality public discussion among citizens that involves people giving reasons for their positions, listening to others, engaging with the evidence, and ideally reflecting on their own position and then adjusting it in line with stronger arguments. And it's something that I talked a bit about in a book that I published last year called Government for the Public Good. And I think for me the importance of deliberation is that if you just get people engaged, and I'm thinking about democratic processes here, if they're just participating but they haven't discussed the issues with others, if they haven't deliberated, then there's no guarantee that what you're getting is people's considered opinion or that it's informed. And it's really only through discussing things with other people that the crowd becomes smarter than the individual, I think, and that you bring the best ideas to the surface. So I'd like to see us sort of moving up the ladder of participation, but also moving up the ladder of deliberation at the same time.
One of the models that we've used around that space is called the Three Voices model, and we talk about this in our article, which is geared at doing exactly that, which is saying, how do we actually see different groups that are contributing into a democratic process for the expertise that they bring to it? I mean, as a citizen of Wellington, I'm not an expert in public transport or transportation networks in Wellington, but I know an awful lot about the decisions that I take on a daily basis about whether to take the bus or walk or take a car to make a trip. However, there are road planners and transportation experts who do actually bring that expertise and understand what that is. So how do we actually bring those two different voices together, together with the intention that government and council is wanting to achieve at a higher level in terms of outcomes around transportation? How do we actually bring those three voices together, acknowledge that there are tensions in that, and use the process in a way that really teases out those tensions and seeks to understand what sits underneath it? I find it fascinating at the moment seeing some of the what we're seeing in the media at the moment about what the citizens of Wellington said they wanted in terms of transportation. And it's, you know, did we want a tunnel under Mount Victoria or did we want that? And it's like, well, I don't actually want any of those things. I want the ability to get to work easily, to be able to go to the swimming pool on the weekend without being stuck in traffic jams for half an hour. I don't really care how you deliver that to me. But that's the piece that I think we often see is missing through these public consultation system processes, is that it's pitting everyone as having views that are equal to each other, as opposed to saying your views are really valuable around the expertise and that you have in terms of how you make your decisions about what transport you take versus this person over here who studied transportation networks, and so we're going to really recognise the expertise that they bring in that space. And I think there's a real shift that we can start to see in public agencies and the way that they're engaging with communities, which would give a lot more weight to those voices of experience and take away the kind of risk you see at the moment and often in these processes where it gets hamstrung by a vocal minority who have jumped on a topic and have some strong views about it.
I think that's a very important point, because arguably people have never deliberated more in terms of the quantity of deliberation and the public nature of that deliberation than they do in the current age. Everybody has a view on everything. Mm. And with social media and digital media being what it is, people are very in a position to very easily express those views. Whether that leads to the quality of deliberation is obviously the crucial factor here. And there's obviously a trade-off to be made between saying, well, we are the experts, or this person is the experts, we'll privilege their voice, which we may need to do for some kind of technical reason, but we want to ensure that other people don't feel excluded from that conversation again. So the balance between participation and deliberation is also a balance between quantity and quality, whether that's of debate and discussion or of decision making. It's also about making sure that the channels are available to try and get that balance as best as possible. And obviously that is no easy feat.
And Michael, what are some of the things that we can do to get that greater and broader engagement of citizens in some of those conversations and you know, help them to participate and ensure that their voices are being heard?
Well, it would depend very much on what the context is around the decision that we're trying to make. So if it's a large national discussion debate, then obviously there needs to be publicity and informed public discussion through a variety of media as to what that is, so that we can try and get people to have, you know, as informed a kind of set of conversations as possible. Small-scale conversations could utilise a number of different ways. Citizens' panels, for example, are very common and popular in the UK in terms of local government, to look at specific local ideas and to pick up on what Anne was saying. You do get that mixture of voices. We also talk about expert citizens and everyday makers in the paper, and you get that blend of people who have the local, regional, common, kind of communal grassroots level knowledge alongside the technical expertise of a legal expert or a planning expert, whatever it may be. But you give them a space and you give them an agenda and you allow them to talk through things in a very well facilitated fashion, so that we can actually tease out which components of the discussion people are really able to contribute to. So again, even if people aren't happy with the decision at the end, you know, people are very happy with the process that they've gone through and more comfortable with the decision. You can get all sorts of other examples. We cite one here again from the UK that I worked on when I was working in local government, about standards committees. So actually allowing members of the public, unelected members of the public, so not local councillors, to sit in to local council standard committees to look at areas of misconduct and complaint. People don't get paid for that, but it's been an incredibly well-received idea after a huge amount of pushback. Because as you can imagine, local councillors say, well, we get voted in every 4 years, that's our accountability mechanism, we don't want people snooping in. But actually, within a few years of this system being inculcated, it was a fantastic success. And although there's been a lot of reforms in the last 5 years in local government, most local councils have kept on a form of the standards committee even when they don't need it, because the public participation and public deliberation that it allowed became so constructive.
One of the things I find really interesting is we're trying to strike this balance between participatory democracy and representative democracy. So participatory democracy, where we have people directly involved in the democratic process, versus representative, where we vote somebody in to speak on our behalf and to represent our views into a decision-making process. And what I've seen over recent years, particularly in local government, is that this shift towards requirements for consultation that come through in legislation is almost giving a lot of local councils an out in terms of being able to pick and choose between whether they want to operate as a participatory in a participatory mechanism or as a representative mechanism, depending on the issue. So in my time on the Kapiti Coast District Council, for example, we would often see situations where councillors would say, oh, well, we can't make a decision on that until we go and talk to the community about that. But another topic would come up and it would be something that an individual feels strongly about, and that same individual would be saying, oh, you know, we've got to lead the community. I was voted in on this platform and we need to make this decision. So what I see as part of the challenge here is that in that confusion, we don't have consistency about the way that there are opportunities for people to participate. We're not clear about when we should be using participatory democracy versus representative democracy. And that can be a particular challenge as well when you look at the diversity of a lot of our governing bodies around the country, and they're often not very diverse at all. So you've got the same people deciding whether to engage the community are the people who are looking at it through their own unconscious biases and worldviews, and so we're not necessarily making particularly structured decisions around that either.
And you could add as well that those sort of requirements for consultation, I mean, although obviously sort of very, you know, well-intentioned, I mean, do come with problems. I mean, it's reasonably clear now that a lot of people are suffering from consultation fatigue, you know, I mean, if they weren't already anyway. And I wonder, do those sort of requirements for consultation even really meet the tests sort of, you know, that you set out in that three voices model, which I really like? Because if you're just consulting people, I mean, you're just getting an individual's feedback, you know, you're not getting them really sitting alongside and blending their views with those of, you know, subject matter experts. For instance, you're not getting people to make trade-offs typically either, because that's, I mean, the work of politics is making trade-offs between things, right? It's not just saying, well, I want X. And so, yeah, I mean, I think those criticisms, sort of the you know, how they use consultation are valid, and I think you could go further and say, well, you know, real participation is probably a lot deeper than consultation, isn't it?
And in the article, it mentions a number of other mechanisms that we could potentially explore to increase civic engagement. And you mentioned trade-offs, Max. Participatory budgeting, for example, is one mechanism to get the citizens involved in making some of those trade-offs. What are some of the other mechanisms or approaches we could use to increase engagement?
Well, I'm quite attracted to, so there are things like citizens' assemblies, and, you know, and Michael mentioned citizen panels, and things where you're bringing together a representative group of citizens, but also putting them in front of experts and the evidence, and, you know, encouraging them to discuss the issues deeply with each other, and come up with a set of recommendations that are hopefully, you know, highly influential on public processes. I'm also quite attracted, to things like participatory budgeting. We've got local councils putting up a proportion of their infrastructure budget to be allocated by public vote, again, after deeply considered discussion. You know, things like national policy conventions in Brazil, where they sort of take a lot of discussions at, you know, the sort of city level and scale them up, aggregate them to regional level and then to the national level, and try to get a sense of the public's view on a particular issue that way. And what I like about particularly those last two things is, I mean, Michael was sort of talking earlier about some of the trade-offs and the balancing, and you're trying to get high quality discussion, but you also want lots of participation. And can you do both those things at once? Because it's much easier to have high quality discussion amongst a small group of people. But what some of those things, like the participatory budgeting, do seem to be able to get both, at least to some extent, and that's why I really like them.
What's your views on the more direct democracy approaches? So sort of like the Swiss model of holding citizens' referenda on every topic, because that's the other thing we seem to be starting to introduce more of, is the number of referenda that are being held seems to be on the increase.
Well, I mean, being from the UK, my views on referenda at the minute are quite jaundiced. I think they've led to some disastrous decisions, purely because we did not get that genuine quality of deliberation and an attachment and a kind of an association with the evidence. Instead, people did what they can often do. They got lulled into a sense of messaging that was blatantly untrue at the end of the day, which I think is very worrying. So again, I think it goes down to context. I think direct democracy works very well at smaller levels. I'd be a little bit more hesitant at national levels. But it would depend on what the question is, and depend on the stakes of the question. And I think even if it's at the larger scale or the smaller scale, and just picking up on something that Max was just talking about, I think the really crucial idea, and going back to the notion of people having agency and that being a form and crucial to their well-being, is that whatever it is, it has to count for something. Because the thing that is the most off-putting and the thing that is the most disempowering is when people engage and they do participate and they do deliberate, and then they have a sense that it was for nothing. And what's really interesting is what we're talking about here. You know, this isn't a 100% kind of movement from A to B, that this is what everything in every government department wants. There are all sorts of policy measures and approaches at the minute that don't necessarily go towards deep deliberation. I'm thinking of kind of behavioural insights approaches, which is much more paternalistic, where people are given a set of choices within a specific architecture where that choice is more or less already made for them, because we've already decided that's the best choice. So in the circumstances like that, so long as it's authentic, so long as the stakes are real, so long as that people know that even if the decision doesn't go their way, that it's an authentic voice that they're being able to give and an authentic choice that they're being able to make, then that's the crucial thing, whether that leads to a referendum or a small-scale discussion or a citizens' panel or whatever the specific form is.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree with that more. I mean, we haven't had a lot of these types of approaches, certainly sort of in Pākehā, New Zealand, but you look at something like the Land and Water Forum. Again, it wasn't quite ordinary citizens taking part, it was stakeholders. But it, you know, appears to have been this really great, deep process that actually got people with apparently irreconcilable views to come to some remarkable kind of consensus. And then the government effectively said, well, we're not really going to implement, you know, a meaningful amount of these recommendations. You know, effectively, you know, sort of, when it was, which has started to dent people's faith in yet another democratic process. Mm-hmm. So I actually think if you're not going to implement the results of these processes, it would be better not to do them at all. Mm-hmm. You know, it's worse to do them badly than to not do them at all. I completely agree on that. And on the referendums point, I would agree with Michael. I'm pretty sceptical about them. In ordinary circumstances, I guess the thing that I battle with sometimes is that things like citizens' assemblies, you know, if they've got, you know, 100 perfectly representative people, in theory, the view that they arrive at has enormous legitimacy, because it's the view that we would all arrive at if we could deliberate under these conditions of, you know, perfect conditions. But it's often very hard to get citizens to accept that, because they weren't part of that discussion. And then you look at the Irish model, you know, where they had a citizens' assembly, the Constitutional Convention, two-thirds citizens, one-third politicians, but they then felt the need for everyone to be involved in some kind of having their say on the conclusions of the citizens' assembly. Now, those referenda went the way that I feel they should have done, so I feel more relaxed about them than the Brexit one, but it still just theoretically is problematic, and I actually don't quite... I'd rather think that you can have citizens' assemblies and other things like that without having to have them sort of ratified by referenda, but can you achieve that within the realities of politics as it stands? I don't know.
I think just an extra dimension of that is something that one of my colleagues and friends, Jonathan Boston, writes a lot about future thinking and being able to kind of plan for much longer term policy outcomes. And I do wonder the extent to which we can do that en masse. You know, the bigger the decision, the more people are involved in the decision, and this is relatively speculative, I accept, but it may be the case that people can't put that future thinking quite into that way. but except in a very vague way that we have now with obviously climate change, everyone knows that we need to act decisively to make better outcomes for the future, to protect against the problems of climate change. It's actually only a small number of people who don't seem to accept that anymore. Unfortunately, they seem to be quite powerful people. But the details of that are something that probably aren't going to be easily put into something like a referendum form.
No, and in fact, I mean, and Dave, the point you made earlier about there are some things within government that are moving in quite, you know, non-deliberative ways. I mean, the setting up of an interim climate change commission, which is going to recommend the budgets. Okay, they won't be binding, but they'll recommend the carbon budgets within which governments have to operate. I mean, that's an explicitly technocratic kind of move. But you know, even me, even though I believe profoundly in the deep democracy line of things, I don't think that's necessarily a bad idea because, A, that does seem to be a model that's worked in the UK, and maybe there are some instances where we need a bit more technocracy, you know, uncomfortable though that is to think about.
Mm. So it sounds as though there is a balance to be struck in terms of, you know, making sure that the information is out there to inform people in terms of the debate and the contributions that they have to make, but also the right mechanisms and combination of mechanisms to find participation or representation and input it into the decisions that need to be made. But it seems that something else has to be true as well, which is that somebody has to be prepared to cede some degree of power or decision rights to citizens in order for civic engagement to work and be meaningful. What's your advice for government and citizens in New Zealand around how best to approach that?
Well, my advice would be to appreciate that we're not starting from with an empty vessel. We're starting from a position where there is a lot of civic participation, as we alluded to at the beginning. So my advice would be to see what already works and to build upon that. It's not that we have to go into these things not knowing anything. It's not like we have to suddenly go, let's look to Norway and Scandinavia or anywhere along the rest of the world to get some inspiration. There's no harm in that. But I think most of the inspiration can come from within Aotearoa. These things are already there. And that's why it's so crucial that there's more public recognition and acknowledgement of them, so then we can have some kind of policy learning as well.
The thing I'd like to see from a government perspective is a lot more clarity around the decision rights when it comes to any particular political process, because I think if we could have more clarity from the outset around, is this a purely technocratic process, like Max was alluding to around the Interim Climate Change Commission, or is this something where you know, let's get Wellie moving at the other end of the spectrum where we're saying we want to go full participatory, we want to, you know, hear everyone's voices and have them a really strong part of this process. But I mean, even in that case, the decision rights are actually still being held at the centre. So there is, I think, I totally agree with Michael when he says we've got a lot of great examples of that in New Zealand, and you look to some of the new iwi power sharing arrangements between iwi and government that are coming through. So the granting of legal personhood to the Whanganui River, for example, and multiple other natural places. So there are some really innovative ways that we're starting to see in New Zealand of sharing that power. But I think the number one thing would actually be to be much more deliberate upfront in government decision-making processes around who is holding that power, and for government to not be afraid that sometimes they don't need to be the one who necessarily holds that power, that it's okay to give that power to other people or to look at other mechanisms that enable them to play more of a facilitation role between different groups rather than a decision-making role in relation to things.
Yeah, and I think just the only point I'd sort of make is that there actually is something in this for politicians, because there's reasonably good evidence that when people engage in these you know, deeply participatory processes, they actually come out of them with greater trust in the policies that are at hand, government as a whole, and the specific politicians that they engage with through citizens panels or whatever. So although in the short term you are asking politicians to give up some of their decision rights, to use Anne's term, there is a long-term benefit for them, and I think the key thing is just trying to convince politicians in an age where there's a lot of distrust that is a long-term trade-off that they need to be making.
Well, I think that's just about all we have time for in this episode. Thanks again to Max and Michael for your time joining us today. You can find the latest State of the State articles at deloitte.com/nz/stateofthestate, where you can also subscribe for future articles. And if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. Join me for future episodes where we'll be talking in more depth about creating an equitable tax system, cultural diversity, inclusive growth, digital inclusion, and our recommendations for a way forward. Thanks for listening.